I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. Welcome to Radio Times. When two African-American men were arrested in a Center City, Philadelphia Starbucks where they were waiting for a friend, the company faced angry protests and charges of racism. Starbucks closed their stores for an afternoon of training for all of their employees about how to recognize bias. Two customers at that Starbucks, Michelle Sahin, who is black, and Melissa DePina, who is white, both witnessed that arrest and did something different. They created From Privilege to Progress to amplify voices speaking out against racism. Our guest, Dolly Chugg, is a social psychologist at the New York University Stern School of Business who specializes in the psychology of good people and understanding the roots of bias. Her new book, The Person You Mean to Be, is about how to recognize your own biases, how to confront them in yourself and in others. And she joins us on Radio Times to talk about how to be a good, or she says, a goodish person. Dolly Chugg, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's a thrill to be here. Thank you for having me,
Marty. You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. So let's begin with some really basic stuff here. What does it mean to be a good person?
Well, Marty, here's the thing. The way it's come to be discussed in our society is in a really tight corner. Being a good person is not being racist, not being a sexist, not being a homophobe, not making any mistakes, not slipping up, not confusing two people of the same race for each other, never making a mistake.
Perfection.
And it's either or. Either you are a good person or you're not. And to make this tight corner we're in, like put it on top of a really tall cliff on top of it, we care deeply about being a good person. Psychologists who study what we call moral identity, how central it is to us that we see ourselves as good people and that other people see us as good people. When they ask people on a 1 to 7 scale how important is this to you, most people put a 6 or a 7. Mm-hmm. That's like a high average. And so tight corner, tall cliff. I really care about being a good person. It's either or, and I'm going to really feel it if I don't hit that good person mark. The problem with all of that, it all would be fine if it matched up to how our minds actually work. And the reality is, from the research that many psychologists, including me, have done, there's a lot of data saying that we are more works in progress.
I want to pick up on several things. You coined a word, good-ish. Mm. I tried to substitute good enough, but I don't think that quite meets your definition.
Yeah.
What you seem to be saying is that most of us, yeah, and I'm assuming, you know, 90-some percent of us, do want to be a good person and perhaps want to be a better person than we actually are. But do we know ourselves?
Yeah, so that's the issue. Now, let's begin with what you define as a good person, what I define as a good person, what every other person may not be the same. We want to be clear that most people, including, by the way, white nationalists, see themselves as good people. Our minds are able to create the vision and match it up to whatever it is we care about. Good enough is a really interesting phrasing around it. What I'm pushing for with goodish is a higher standard. And by higher standard, I mean what happens when you make the mistakes. If the mistakes are inevitable, and they are, according to the science, what happens next? And goodish says, I'm going to expect the mistakes, I'm going to expect to be a work in progress, and so when I make the mistakes, I am accountable for them. I will own them. And that's where I like the idea that goodish is pushing us towards holding ourselves more accountable, as you said, knowing ourselves better, as opposed to holding this unicorn idea that isn't realistic.
Do we think then we are better than others perceive us to be?
Yeah.
And I'm speaking very broadly here.
Yeah. So we are remarkably capable of finding, you know, if someone else were to submit that on their expense report, we would roll our eyes a little bit. But we think to ourselves, no, we talked about work at that dinner. We are remarkably able. We also know our own inner motivations better than we know the motivations of others. And so we can tap into the benefit of the doubt piece more easily when we look at ourselves. So for lots of reasons, both virtuous and more just practical, we will see ourselves better than others will typically see us.
In a sense, I mean, it sounds like we're pretty able to justify our own behavior to ourselves.
Yes, remarkably. In fact, we almost have to. It's a survival mechanism. So psychologists refer to self-threat. Self-threat is any identity you care about. I care about being seen as a good mom. I care about being seen as a good professional. Any identity I care about being seen as a good person. Anything that threatens it, whether it's coming from inside me or from someone outside me, I go into the red zone, and so does everyone else. And that's a very human response to psychological protection. What happens when we're in the red zone depends on our belief of whether or not we can actually recover and learn in that moment. And there's some interesting research that can help guide us on that.
And is the red zone, oh, no, I'm not?
Oh, no, I'm not.
Or you are wrong?
How dare you?
How dare you say this?
You have no idea. I help so many people. Yes. The red zone is one that's characterized by either defensiveness, or it can also be characterized by shame. The emotion of shame is paralyzing. When we feel shame, our whole being is called into question, and we tend to become more passive than active.
And shame, I mean, I always think of shame as this physical, there's a physical feeling that goes with feeling ashamed. You can feel it in your body.
That's fascinating. And I don't know that research, but I bet it's out there that would connect those physical feelings to shame. Shame is actually, people who study moral emotions like shame and guilt distinguish between the two. Shame leads to less action. Guilt leads to more. And the difference between the two is when I feel shame, I'm feeling something about myself as a whole. When I feel guilt, I'm feeling something about my behaviors. And when I, if I'm honed in on a behavior, I can address the behavior. So I actually act more from guilt and less from shame.
So let's flip it. And, and instead of being enraged or feeling defensive or shame, if someone says, you know, you really hurt my feelings, or I was really offended when you said X, Y, or Z. What would a good person do?
Well, what a good person would do is say, I'm really sorry you're offended, or that's not what I meant. Let me explain what I meant. What a good good-ish person would do is activate what Carol Dweck, psychologist at Stanford, calls a growth mindset. So in a growth mindset, you view yourself as a work in progress. You're a goodish person, work in progress. And when someone says, that was really offensive, you say, I'd like to learn more. Do you have time to tell me
what I did?
Tell me more. I have a colleague who I didn't know well at all, like barely knew to say hello in the hallways by name. And he had been given the task of introducing a speaker, someone in our group, and he introduced her. And I really was taken, like, in a bad way by the introduction. It felt like it diminished her. She was a woman of color. I was really bristling afterwards. And I, of course, did what any reasonable person would do. I went and told everyone behind his back how terrible that was.
I was wondering where you were going with that.
And then one of my friends, you know, finally said, you know, it's fine that you're telling everyone else this. How about you go share it with him so he could learn from it? And I was like, no way. You know, I'm going to go tell this guy, this white male that I think he said something sexist and racist. Like, no. And she pushed me to do it. And her name is Christina Olson. She's a wonderful psychologist. And I went to his door and sheepishly knocked and said, I don't know if you know who I am, but I really think your introduction was inappropriate.
And was that the word you used?
I think I used something like that, and I may have thrown in racist and sexist. And he said, do you have time to come in? I would really love to hear more.
Wow.
Todd Rogers is now one of my closest friends.
Right.
He that wasn't just a line. He really wanted to hear more. He was absolutely open to the fact that he had a blind spot there. That's what we do when we're goodish people, is we welcome the opportunity. That doesn't mean we always in the end are going to agree to every critique of ourselves. But what if we honor the fact that someone had the courage to speak up?
And were you able to then to did you feel comfortable enough to say, since he opened the door to this, to be honest with him and to give him your honest assessment of what you heard and observed?
Yeah, I mean, I will grant that I tiptoed. Like, I was sort of, the more he was open, the more I was open, because I was absolutely, I describe myself in this book as a semi-bold person. I am not at all a firebrand. I am not the one who's going to have all the courage and do all the brave things. This was a big moment for me and a scary one.
And a scary one. There's another way to look at that anecdote, which is also to say, is it easier for us to recognize bias, racism, sexism in other people than we do in ourselves?
It is. The studies would support that. That it is, the noticing is, of course, again, for all the reasons we talked about earlier, that we have access to our own motivations and not to others. We are able to see it. That said, we also actually, noticing the stuff that's baked in around us also escapes a lot of us. You know, I think a lot of us are seeing it with the Me Too movement right now. You know, those of us who are women of a certain age grew up with a lot of stuff that we, frankly, just accepted. And it wasn't like we were grappling a lot with it. We were sort of normalizing it ourselves in certain cases. And now when we look and we notice through different eyes, we see things that we were just assuming were baked into how things were. That's part of what happens. You open the fridge and you look for the butter. And you can, who finished the butter and didn't put it on the list? There's no butter here. And then someone shows you the butter right in front of you. It is a completely part of how our minds work, that a lot of stuff is right in front of us, but we don't notice it. And we've got studies that say at any given moment, 11 million pieces of information are coming into our brain. Only 40 are being noticed consciously.
Is that because it's just overload, or just the way our brain separates and sorts information?
It's the latter. It's actually the brilliance of the brain. The fact that our brains are incredibly robust and we can process language and temperature and people and a million thoughts in our head and do that all with minimal conscious processing. All that's happening in low power mode in the back of our brain. The work that we're doing consciously is just a very small fraction of what's happening in our brain, and that's what allows us to function so well.
Almost up in a break here, and is that why it's so important to understand what unconscious bias is about?
That's perfect setup. Yes, that's exactly what it is. Unconscious bias is part of that stuff that's happening outside of our awareness.
Well, I do want to pick up on that, but first, a very short break, talking with Dolly Chug, and she's a psychologist, also associate professor of management and organizations at the Stern School of Business. That's at New York University. She's got a new book we're talking about called The Person You Mean to Be, How Good People Fight Bias. Much more to talk about after this very short break, and we do want to hear from you, questions or comments or anecdotes as well. And again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org, and also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And just to underscore what our guest says is that we all do this stuff. No one is perfect in this world. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. We are all biased. Even the most well-intentioned of us are prone to making all sorts of internal judgments about someone's race or ethnicity or gender or age. Our guest psychologist, Dolly Chug, says there are things we can do about it to fight those impulses, to confront biases in ourselves, confront them in others, and also in the world around us. And again, 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Help us understand then unconscious bias.
Yes, exactly. And sometimes unconscious bias is also called implicit bias. We can use those terms interchangeably. So if we if we continue with this train of thought that a lot of the work of the brain is happening outside of our awareness, and that's a good thing, that's why we're able to do the things that humans do, that also means that there's content in our brain that we aren't aware is bubbling up. And so, for example, if I say peanut butter, you say?
Jelly.
Exactly. If I say twinkle, twinkle, you say?
Little star.
You didn't have to think about that. Right. That was sitting back there, and it's not probably, unless you happen to have a very specific memory around those things, you don't know when they became associated in your mind. Well, there's lots of other things associated in our mind as well. And what cognitive psychologists have discovered is that how quickly we can associate two things, peanut butter, jelly, also reflects how strongly associated they are in our brains. And so measuring something like unconscious or implicit bias, one way to do that is to measure the speed of those associations in our minds. There's a test that's been developed. Brian Nosek, Mazreen Banaji, and Tony Greenwald are the world-class researchers behind this test called the Implicit Association Test, or IAT. And it's a measure that's constantly evolving and getting better. It's not a perfect measure, but it is one way, using an internet connection in 10 minutes on your computer, where you can get your own score of your unconscious bias. You go to implicit.harvard.edu. You don't need to give any personal information. Just go in as a guest. And then you pick the topic that you want to explore. Let's say you pick race.
Sure.
When you pick the race test, then you'll spend 10 minutes using your keyboard to respond quickly. And I really mean quickly, like millisecond quickly.
Don't think too much.
You can. In fact, it'll tell you if you're going too slow. It's like a video game, like boom, 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 boom. And it's seeing how quickly you can associate things and when you have to slow down. So on the race IAT, it asks you to associate words that are good or bad with white faces and black faces. And what they now have, over 30 million tests have been taken at this public website, that implicit.harvard.edu. And the vast majority of white Americans are faster at associating white and good than black and good, what we would call implicit pro-white bias. And one very reasonable reaction to that is, well, wouldn't we expect people to have more positive feelings for their own group? Implicit pro-white bias for white people seems normal and expected, but we don't get the same responses when African Americans take the test. It's more split. It doesn't flip like mirror image, where we see the majority of African Americans showing an implicit pro-black bias. It actually is more kind of split across.
Interesting.
And that's a reflection of all that stuff that's in our mind, all those associations. We're not born with those associations. We're born with the wiring to make associations, but the actual content is coming from the world around us.
Is it which raises the question. So what causes that kind of association?
Yeah. So it's all the inputs, those 11 million things that are coming in every moment from the moment we're born and maybe before, that are feeding our brains. Beverly Daniel Tatum has a great metaphor for this. She calls it smog, that we're breathing it in, and sometimes it's visible to us. Like, it's really obvious to us. I'm seeing very strong association between men and presidency. Like, we have all male presidents. That's really visible to us.
Right.
But there's lots of other ways in which we may not realize we are making strong associations between male and leadership. Maybe we don't really notice that in movies, media scholars have shown and documented that women have far more spoken words in movies than men do, that our movies haven't really changed over the last 30 years in that dimension when they statistically measure these things. That maybe isn't popping up for us as something that's actually embedded in our brains.
But might be working unconsciously. And isn't that true in real life as well, that women use more words than men? Is that true?
I don't know the answer to that. In the movies, what's happening is that women's roles are more subservient to men. Yeah, exactly. And you know, these studies they've done, they analyze every frame of every movie of the last 30 years, the top 100 movies of every year, and it's stunning what they come up with. It if you looked at the data about our movies, you would think we were living in a different planet.
Oh, that's so interesting. You did an interesting study with some other researchers having to do with implicit bias, I guess we should say, sending out something like a letter from candidates with various different names asking for a 10-minute meeting.
Yeah.
Sending out to something like 6,500 professors across all sorts of disciplines. First of all, different kinds of signatures. What kinds of names were, I guess, made or used up for this?
Yes.
Made up for this.
So we created names that were either male-sounding or female-sounding using a gender binary, and white-sounding, black-sounding, Hispanic-sounding, Chinese-sounding, or Indian-sounding. Mm-hmm. So those two genders, five race ethnicities, if you cross them, we have about 10 identities. And so each professor, these are real professors in their real inboxes, they don't know they're part of a study, we debrief them later, get an email that's actually pretty typical for professors to get saying, I'm interested in your research, would you be willing to meet, as you said. And the question, the dependent variable we were interested in is who would write back and who
right.
wouldn't. And this is a cold call email, they're really not obligated to write back. We get a lot of these. It's very hard to keep up with all of them. And we are the way we analyzed the data was we were interested in our white male students, how their response rate compared to the non-white male students. And I should mention, by the way, even though we get a lot of these emails and can't respond to all of them, they do have a meaningful impact on PhD admissions. It's not unusual for these meetings and conversations to lead to actual mentorships. And my co-authors, Katie Milkman, who lives here in Philadelphia,
yep.
and Madhupe Akinola at Columbia, all three of us had sent these kinds of emails before we were in
PhD. So you were one of those students.
Yes, we are. And I'm Indian American. Madhupe is African American. And Katie is white American. So we were fascinated by this question. Here's what happened. Our white males, 87% of them received a response from the professors. Our non-white male students, 62% received a response. That's a really meaningful difference on something that we don't usually measure. This is a very informal behavior with meaningful consequences. And I want to add, we didn't measure. We don't know if that was unconscious bias or not, right?
Well, that was my next question.
Oh, thank you.
Is that a sign of unconscious bias?
We don't know for sure. As a scientist, I have to tell you, I have no idea.
Right.
As someone who lives in the world and works in academia, I have to say, I got to believe some of it's unconscious bias. I work with colleagues who care deeply about diversity and inclusion. I don't think this can all be explained by conscious bias.
Interesting. And let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Dolly Chug, and she's a psychologist, associate professor of management and organizations at the Stern School of Business. That's at New York University. Again, author of a new book we've been talking about, The Person You Mean to Be, How Good People Fight Bias. We have calls and comments coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I am a robot here. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. Let me see what Nancy from Philadelphia has to say. Nancy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there, Nancy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. This is a perfect show for me today. I was speaking to a cousin last night, and she just recently found out her granddaughter has cancer, and she was commenting that there were people in the hospital who were wearing
hijab,
Muslim garb. They had, completely in black, and she said even their eyes weren't exposed. She tends to exaggerate, but and she just went off on them, and I was so upset. I couldn't even sleep last night, and I'm going to be seeing her in a few weeks, and I don't know how to approach it. I don't want to come at her with both guns blazing, but I feel I have to say something. So do you have any suggestions about how to handle that?
Nancy, it's a great question. I think you called in the right place and perhaps the right person, because you deal with some of this in your book, and you have had your own experiences, as I think we all have, about how to confront whatever the word is, someone who says something that you find offensive.
Right. Absolutely. And thank you for calling, Nancy. I want to make sure I got this right. So it's your cousin who you are interested in potentially talking to.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. So So this one's tricky, Nancy. And so first of all, your cousin's going through something terrible. And when we are in states of fearful emotion, as I expect she is, and we all send her our prayers to her granddaughter, it doesn't bring out the best of us. So there is an opportunity here to have grace for the emotion she's feeling. That said, the possibility here, there's a possibility to use what I call the 20-60-20 rule. Mm-hmm. I didn't make this up. I'm just applying it to these types of situations. Lucia Annunzio coined the rule. And the way it works is when you're interested in moving people in a new direction and changing them, 20% of the people are going to be like, yes, I'm in, let's go. And 20% of the people are going to be no way. And Annunzio calls that the comfortably miserable around that issue. And then 60% of the people are kind of in the middle and aren't really engaged in this particular topic. Now, you might be the 20 on one thing and the 60 on another. It's not like a personality trait. It's just where you are in a particular topic. So on this issue, one thing I would encourage you to think about is where you think your cousin is on the issue.
Is there a pattern? Would that be an
Is there a pattern?
Is there a pattern of saying disparaging things about
exactly
Muslims?
Exactly. And is there an openness to conversation on it? I want to be clear. I'm not saying that we should just allow things to go unchecked, but your approach changes based on whether it's 20-60 or 20. If you think she's in the 20 that's like has blind spots like the rest of us, but like the friend Todd Rogers I described earlier would welcome a conversation about the blind spots, then I absolutely encourage you, when the time is right, understanding what she's going through with her granddaughter, to have that conversation and not to worry too much about how you have it. If you think she's in the 20, the other 20 that is going to dig her heels in, I think you say something, but you don't get into an argument about it. You're not going to get anywhere with it.
Just sort of recognize, I saw this, it upset me.
I just want you to know. And I think that at a time when you deserved as much peace as possible, you may have created more distress for yourself than you needed to. There was no danger in that moment from those sources. And I worry that you're creating an unnecessary stressor in your own mind right now. There was nothing to worry about. If she's in the middle 60, and obviously most people are, the thing to do there is to tell stories. When people don't have strong opinions on subjects, psychologists who study influence say what is more likely to persuade them is stories than science. Humanize the issue. And so if you already know Muslims who wear the garb, you could tell a story about that. If you don't, you could perhaps educate yourself, watch a show, follow some Twitter feeds, and say, hey, I remember you said something the other day, and then funny thing, I caught this program and it really opened my eyes. I got to tell you this story. And begin to humanize the issue. The thing with the middle 60 is they tend to be a little quieter in their views. And so we forget they're there. We spend too much time engaging with the 20 that isn't going to change. And we wear ourselves out. We piss them off. Upset them, and the consequence is that we don't make headway with the people we really can move in the middle.
Which raises, I think, and thank you, Nancy, for that call, and I found that helpful. Hopefully you did as well. It does raise questions about these partisan, angry times that we live in, where people have carved out camps for themselves, often see the other side as if not wrong, perhaps even the enemy. And I think there's just a lot of upset and kind of roiled feelings about who is right, who is wrong, where's our future, all that. It feels like a lot is at stake.
Absolutely.
And I think there's a real rawness that many people feel.
Absolutely. Well, and one thing that I've found useful to think about during these times is this distinction between heat and light. I don't know who to credit this metaphor to, but it's really helpful. So here's the difference. Heat is about confrontation, controversy, conflict, making a point known without worrying about the comfort of the other person. So protests can be one form of heat. Arguments or where you the tone, one does not worry about their tone in expressing their displeasure. Heat. Light is more, I'm going to walk you through what I'm feeling. I'm going to meet you where you are. I'm going to monitor my tone. It's going to be about education. And those, we tend to, each of us, you know, I'm more of a light person than a heat person. I'm not, you know, I don't even want to tell my husband that I don't like how he puts the forks in the dishwasher. I mean, like, it, you know, I'm...
Well, you know what, the cat is out of the bag.
Exactly.
Okay.
So But then there's other people who are more equipped to be right. heat. And one thing we have to be really careful of in these trying times is that the light people don't diminish the heat people and the heat people don't diminish the light people. And here's why. It's really clear when you look at historical social justice movements that the ones that were most effective were the ones that had both.
Interesting. When to use both.
Exactly. Now, each person doesn't have to be able to do both, but we need a radical flank and we need a moderate flank. We need people to bring the heat and we need people to bring the light. So during these trying times when everyone's fighting and everyone's angry, those of us who are light people can be like, well, can't we just all get along? If they would only speak in a better way, these protests aren't doing anything. I sometimes hear those words want to come out of my mouth. We need to check that. We need the heat people to keep bringing the heat, and we need to support them.
And I guess knowing which one you are.
Exactly. And the heat need to do the same for the light.
I'm curious how you got – is there – I mean, I read some press material about the psychology of good people or being a good person. Is that a growing part of psychology? I know there's the happiness part of the psychology movement. Is that connected?
The positive psychology movement.
Positive?
Yeah. So I think I coined the phrase the psychology of good people, and I think what I'm just doing is putting a word on a lot of work that's been done for a long time that is sometimes described as moral psychology or behavioral ethics by people in the right. field. And I'm just a drop in the bucket in that research, but it's a work that's been going on for a while.
Is it as a personal? I mean, it must be. There must have been something that got you interested in that.
Oh, yeah.
You personally.
Yeah, for sure. I feel like I care deeply about being a person, and like every day I'm screwing up. I'm the professor who does confuse two students of the same race who look nothing alike for each other in front of a whole group of students. Mm-hmm. I'm the professor who describes herself as a feminist, is trying to raise two feminist daughters, and then gets an email from a student saying that I've assigned a sexist reading, and I go into the red zone of defensiveness, and how dare she and these students today, and blah, 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 blah. And then I read the reading, which I've, by the way, read 100 times, and I read it through the lens of her email, and I say, holy moly, how dare I assign this? She was right. And I had normalized sexism so much that it didn't even dawn on me. So I'm that person. So I'm studying. They call all research is me search.
Great. We're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. Again, Dolly Chugg is our guest. We're talking about her new book, The Person You Mean to Be, How Good People Fight Bias. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen, again talking with Dolly Chugg about her new book, The Person You Mean to Be, How Good People Fight Bias. You talk in here, and I should say to our listeners, you come from the business world into the world of academia. So you have some experience about being involved in meetings, running meetings. But you also say something, and this is I'm a bit of a stickler for making sure I pronounce people's names correctly.
Yeah,
my producers will underscore that. I feel like it's if you're sitting across from me, I don't say your name correctly. Yeah. Something is seriously wrong. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. And, I have to confess, I in a lot of ways doing the research for this book, I learned and grew myself, and this is one of them. My default response when I don't know how to say a name is to avoid saying it and to avoid the person, quite frankly. It's very uninclusive for someone who cares deeply about inclusion. What changed it was interviewing Sarah Weeks and Geetha Varadharajan. Sarah Weeks and Geetha Varadharajan were writing a book together. Sarah's a very established children's author, Geetha's first book. So Sarah was having to introduce her to a lot of people in the business and was scared to say her last name.
Oh, wow.
Multi-syllable South Indian name. Well, it turns out in the book they're writing together, there's a character who's just immigrated from India as well, has a similar name. And in the book, Geetha wrote a draft where nobody was saying his name. Sarah, who thought this was going unnoticed, her not saying the name, read this draft and said, I'm just curious, Geetha, why do you think no one's saying his last name? And Geetha doesn't flinch. She says, arrogance.
Oh. Wow.
And
arrogance.
Arrogance. And Sarah says, oh, gosh, because she wasn't saying her name because she didn't want to offend her and she didn't want to look stupid. And she cares deeply about Geet. That was just the opposite of arrogance. But those intentions didn't matter. The impact was mm-hmm. very real. That ended up leading to a really honest conversation where Sarah committed herself to learning how to say her name. Geetha helped her. Sarah went home, and actually when she practiced a little bit, it didn't take long. She's like, if I can say supercalifragilisticexpialidocious, I can learn how to say Varadhrajan if I can say the names on Game of Thrones. This story really affected me because my family comes from North India. We tend to have shorter, like my last name is Chug, my husband's last name is Singh. But I've been avoiding saying South Indian names, and these are people from my country, my heritage. And so if Sarah Weeks can learn, I can learn. And so I committed myself to taking a different approach to names as well. It turns out if you go on any internet search engine, you Google how to pronounce and you put in any name, I have yet to put in a name where I don't get immediately audio files that will say the name aloud for me. It's not that hard to learn. I'm surprised companies don't have this in all their databases where they have all our other information, have an audio file of us saying our names.
Because it's what we call ourselves.
Exactly.
It is our identifier. I mentioned this to you off the air, but I'll do it on the air, which is we've had several guests who don't want the word he or she to be used in describing them. Oftentimes it's they or a more neutral word. And I have screwed up on the air, admitted my mistakes.
Yes.
But I think it also underscores this very powerful feeling when you identify yourself a certain kind of way and being recognized for that.
Exactly. And names and pronouns are in the same category of this is the identity I'm claiming and will you honor it?
Right.
We're all grappling right now in changing times. And I too am struggling with pronouns and trying to do better and trying to educate myself, frankly. I'm still not even sure I understand the appropriate norms. I talk about that in the book that one of the wonderful people I interviewed was Mel Wymore. And he was the first transgender person that I know I've met. I'm sure I've met others. And my own sort of regrets about not being more comfortable in that conversation.
Right. For all a very subtle but very obviously very important reasons as well. You also talk about, and I guess this comes from your business experience, about how to run a meeting and that how you run a meeting can reveal in many ways the kind of person that you are. Can you break that down for
exactly.
us?
And it's how to run a meeting and even how to be in a meeting. Yes. You don't even have to be the one running it. You know, I teach MBA students, and in one of my classes, we do a whole week on how to run meetings, Meetings 101. At the same time, I interviewed Tony Proffitt, the chief equality officer at Microsoft, and at Salesforce, excuse me. And he asked him, so you're a chief equality officer. What big things are you doing? I was expecting some groundbreaking initiative. And there are groundbreaking initiatives. But to my surprise, his first response was, we're teaching people how to run better meetings.
Wow.
So it was like, this is interesting because I'm teaching my MBAs how to run better meetings just because that makes you a better manager. And he's saying this has something to do with equity and inclusion and diversity. How are these two connected? Well, they're completely connected, he taught me. He said, what's happening in your organization, who's getting credit, who's not, who's getting interrupted, who's getting left out, who's getting heard, who has the freedom to disagree, who has the freedom to be angry, that's all happening in your meetings as well. So all the things we're trying to work on in a really macro, big, systemic way, we can start by balancing airtime in the meetings. We can start by making it okay for people to disagree and making sure they know how to do it constructively. Mm-hmm. These are inclusion hacks. We can start with the stuff that's right in front of us.
Interesting. There's a caller we can't take. Kathy saying, my mother's 97 in a nursing facility. She points out when people help her that they're Black. That's a thing we often do in society, only notice the race of Black people, which gets to something else that you write in this book, a woman who you call Laurie. This is talking about race. And Laurie says, I don't even think of myself as white. And I think it's such a provocative thing to say.
Yeah.
What does that reveal to us?
Yeah, it's so Lori is an incredible person who, as a white person, is very similar to what the research shows for the majority of white people in America, that because whiteness is both statistically seen in most people around us, and it's also seen in most positions of power, it's normalized in a way. And people who study what's called racial identity development show that most white people are not deeply aware of their race in the United States in the same way that people of color are. That's a normal progression. And as a result, it's what I call something called ordinary privilege.
Yeah.
The part of your identity that you think least about is probably the one where there's also some potential blind spots and opportunities to have influence. I go months without thinking about the fact that I'm straight. I have to do any sort of calculus over who I can share what with. And as a result, that's an ordinary part of my life. It's an ordinary part of the world I live in. And it's my ordinary privilege because it probably means those are issues where I could have some real influence if I spoke up. Research shows that when a person from a targeted group speaks up, they are viewed as whinier than if the person from outside that group speaks up on that issue.
Let me raise a couple of things in response to that. So when Laurie says, I don't even think of myself as white, I'm sure people of color think of her as white, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because race is something that it's socially constructed. But if we're going to accept that it's part of our society, then we all have a race. But what tends to happen is those of us of the majority race will not categorize it as part of our identity. Mm-hmm. Beverly Daniel Tatum has done some exercises in class that she describes where she says she just asks people to write I am and then fill in whatever blank they want in that blank, and that she finds that her white students tend not to include race at all or early in the sentence, whereas people of color do.
You mentioned ordinary privilege, and you write to some degree about that in the book, and I think when I first read it, I struggled to understand exactly what you meant, but explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, so the ordinary part is this idea that I don't have to think about it, that it kind of blends in with the way the world works around me. The privilege part of it is, you know, the term has become very charged, privilege, check your privilege. But here I'm actually offering it as, okay, yes, you've got some tailwinds working in your favor on that dimension because it fits in with the world around you. But you've also got this real influence, this superpower that you may not be aware of. Not to speak over people, not to speak for people. I certainly should not be speaking for gay people. But I should be aware that if there's all these ways in which social events at my workplace are more geared for people who have heterosexual partners, then maybe there's opportunities for me to ask some questions or design events differently. Mm-hmm. That's my ordinary privilege. It's really an opportunity to do the things so many of us want to do, which is be supportive of diversity and inclusion.
And we all have that.
We all have ordinary privilege because no matter who we are, the ordinary privilege is not limited to race or sex. It could be the fact that I'm a native English speaker in a land where that's the native language. It could be that I have citizenship. It could be that I'm Christian in a nation that's majority Christian. It could be that I'm able to see, I'm able to hear. These are all forms of ordinary privilege.
I wanted to ask you about diversity because that's also part of this. And Tucker Carlson said recently on his Fox show, how precisely is diversity our strength? He was responding, I believe, to President Obama, who's now out on the trail and talking about diversity and other things as well. But he said, how precisely is diversity our strength, meaning are the United States' strength? Do you have an answer to that?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Well, I mean, it's an interesting question because certainly studies show that diversity can be a strength in organizations and teams, but studies also show, and Kathy Phillips and others have compiled these studies and done a really robust analysis of it, that there's also lots of ways in which diversity can be an impediment if we don't actually leverage it. So diversity without inclusion, meaning like having people in the room, but like not actually like, you know, appropriately leveraging their talent and perspective, actually can slow us down. Diversity is our aspirational strength. I think we're works in progress and actually manifesting it.
Let me read some comments. We had a tweet early on. Humans are very good at pattern recognition. Stereotypes are often based on kernels of truth. How can you fight stereotypes unless you acknowledge the truths which originally bore them into life?
Yeah, absolutely. I think a piece of that, the kernel of truth, argument is recognizing what led to that kernel of truth. So, for example, one of the things that I will confess I had no idea about was that the GI Bill, which transformed our country and created incredible wealth that we still see in home ownership and college education, in the rise of the middle class in America, World War II veterans being honored for their service, was largely excluded through a variety of mechanisms, Black veterans. So when we say kernel of truth about whites being more educated than Blacks, or whites having more money than Blacks, and making lots of inferences as to why that is, are we acknowledging that the biggest predictor of whether you own a home is whether your parents and grandparents did? The biggest predictor of whether you go to college is whether your parents and grandparents did. And we had an extreme gap emerge after World War II between whites and Blacks in this country. We don't even have to go as far back as slavery. Within the last two generations, we widened that gap with the GI Bill. So kernel of truth, absolutely, but let's understand where that truth is coming from.
An email from Conrad, great show. As an older white male, I've learned to see myself as that, or tried to, and it has really helped me relate better to others. Thanks for reinforcing this idea. There are many things going on in this book, but one is the word humility. I mean, it's important to humility. It's hard sometimes to be humble, but nonetheless, something to strive for if you're a goodish person.
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Humility is a powerful, powerful trait in all parts of our life. I will tell you this: like all things, these things get easier with practice, and it's funny that when it comes to learning how to cook or learning the new computer system at work, we give ourselves room to grow. We allow ourselves to be works in progress, and we allow ourselves the joy of learning and exhilaration. Why in this dimension that we care so deeply about being a good person, do we deny ourselves room to grow? Hmm. I'm so happy that this caller is allowing himself that growth and inspires me to do the same.
Also, another word that I thought about embedded in your book is also empathy, the ability to see the world through someone else's eyes and experience.
Absolutely. And that's a big part of this, is honoring the fact that someone's experience may be hurtful for us to hear. If somebody who's transgender is telling me their experience, and it's hard for me to hear because I'm unknowingly contributing to some of what creates discomfort in that person's life, that's hard for me to listen to and not argue with or withdraw from. To just bear witness to it and hear it. That's part of the empathy that we're all striving for here. And it's what we want for others to give us as well.
Which is imagine you're in this situation.
Exactly.
Or imagine that you are that person.
Exactly. And to humanize the issues through empathy. Mm-hmm. Some studies show that we literally look at people's faces differently when we dehumanize them. We literally are seeing different features, like through brain scans and eye tracking. And so empathy is a matter of truly seeing people as humans.
As you said, research is me-search. So are you a better person now?
Well, I'm certainly trying. I have to say, one of the things that happens when you notice more is that you become more aware of your mistakes, not less of. So I see them a lot, but I do think I have learned a lot, particularly from the people I interviewed in this book. It's been a powerful learning experience.
In what way?
I think a lot of us feel like we're out there grappling and struggling on our own, and these topics are so hard to talk about. One of the things that I'm benefiting from, and readers have told me they're benefiting from, is having a vocabulary to have these conversations with other people and creating almost like, I would call, like micro learning communities, like where you have someone to talk to, like whether it's your book club or your spouse or a colleague, someone to talk to about the mistakes you're making and what it would look like to do better. And so I think that's those stories. You know, I interviewed Joe McNeil, who was one of the four college freshmen in the Greensboro Four. Remember the Woolworth's lunch counters, 1960? Would lead to a complete desegregation of Woolworth's lunch counters. He tells a story in the book where he's still giving himself room to grow, mid-70s. No one has served his country and this cause more than him, and he's still inspired to grow. Gosh, if he can, I can too.
Dolly Chugg, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
It's been an absolute thrill. Thank you for letting me see a master at work, Marty.
Oh, there you go. And her book is called The Person You Mean to Be, How Good People Fight Bias. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.